From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Megan Mack. Thanks, as always, for joining me for our weekly review of what happened on Connections. We had a packed week on the show, including an interview with Governor Andrew Cuomo about state funding for rebuilding areas affected by Lake Ontario flooding. You can find that conversation on our website at wxxinews.org/connections. We had a chance to talk with the governor for a full 30 minutes. And I mention that because if you listen to Connections or this podcast every week, you know that we feel so fortunate to have the time to learn about issues and tell stories on our show, 52 minutes twice a day. We think that's a valuable opportunity for us and for you, our listeners. And if you agree, we'd love to have your support during our fall membership campaign to keep WXXI and Connections going strong. You can call 585-454-6300 or go online to wxxinews.org to pledge your support. And thank you for everyone who has done so. Thank you so much. As I mentioned, we covered a lot of ground on this week's show, and I'll start this podcast with a conversation about compassion and forgiveness in the criminal justice system. Earlier this month, jurors found a Texas police officer guilty of murder for fatally shooting a St. Lucia native in his Dallas home. Officer Amber Geiger was off duty when she killed Botham Jean in 2018. During the conclusion of the murder trial, Jean's younger brother told Geiger that he forgave her, and he gave her a hug. We talked about the role of forgiveness and restorative justice in the justice system. In this clip, you'll hear Ronnie Pollack, executive director of the Native American Cultural Center. But first, here's Danielle Ponder, a criminal defense attorney. She's reacting to how the judge in the Jean case hugged Officer Geiger after her conviction.
I've never seen any, and most probably defense attorneys
never
will
once.
Tell you, they've never seen anything like that.
A judge hugging one of your clients.
Oh my goodness, what? Just the thought of it is like mind-blowing that a judge would get down from the bench. And maybe people who aren't in court don't realize how shocking that is. But for a judge to get down from the bench and hug a client, maybe in mental health court or drug court, but I haven't even seen it there. But it's really, judges really tried to be impartial. Typically, they lean towards chastising clients more, especially a murder defendant. Are you kidding me? That would never happen. But I do think there's something powerful in that moment. And so when I look at just the human beings in the courtroom, I can't take away from how beautiful it is to be able to show compassion in that way. But we have to talk about the nuances in the case.
So before I turn to the other guests, one more question for you on that subject. Here's what Jamel Hill wrote. She's a staff writer for the Atlantic Monthly after Judge Tammy Kemp also hugged Amber Geiger. Hill wrote the following, quote, "How Botham Jean's brother chooses to grieve is his business. He's entitled to that. But this judge choosing to hug this woman is unacceptable to me. Keep in mind, this is a convicted murderer, the same one who laughed about Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination and killing people on sight." End quote. Mm-hmm. That's Jamel Hill. What she seems to be saying there is, similar to what you said, okay, the brother is going to grieve in his way. And there may be something beautiful in that act of forgiveness. But this is a judge, and there's a different standard, and there's a different idea here. And what Jamel Hill is saying is, I don't see the kind of contrition that I wanted to see in Amber Geiger. The laughing about MLK, laughing about killing people on site.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. I mean, I think if we had a different system, if we had a community-oriented system that was based in restorative justice, we could receive this. But Jamel Hill also knows what happens to Black defendants, what happens to Latino defendants. So I think it's striking for many people because we've seen our brothers and our sisters and our cousins go through the court process. We've seen them yelled at by judges. We've seen judges be cold and not listen to mitigating consequences or mitigating circumstances. That happens all the time. So for us to see a white woman kind of lifted up in this way by the court is really hard to process. I definitely think the judge goes a step too far. But I would love to see a system where love is the guiding principle. And so if I believe that, then it has to be for everyone. And, you know, it kind of feels icky to even say it, but it's just the truth. If I want that thing, then anyone who walks in that court has to receive it.
I respect that struggle that you have with it. I respect that you opening up about sort of the ambivalence you may feel. Ronnie Pollack, let me just start with the Botham Jean case, and then I want to kind of broaden it out to questions on some of the similar themes that Danielle just discussed. But what did you make of that particular case and that act of forgiveness?
Yeah, I think when I saw that act of forgiveness, it just resonated with me just based on my experience with forgiveness and how I've worked with clients in the past before on the topic of forgiveness, my own experiences that I've had in the area of forgiveness. So to me, it wasn't as big of a shock as it is, I think, for many other people in our society, because that's just not our knack, you know? It's just not a part of our human nature to look at a situation like that and be like, oh yeah, well, forgiveness makes sense. You know, I mean, it seems as though what comes to mind right away is no, there needs to be accountability and, you know, they need to serve whatever is due to them, you know, that had the judgment that has been brought upon them. And sometimes almost holding this thought of like, well, they have to earn forgiveness. But when you really experience forgiveness, you recognize that it's nothing that can be earned. It's a gift that the person doing the act of forgiveness gives to the person that maybe collectively all the other people see as, well, that's undeserved. But that's not the common aspect of focus.
Next, a forthcoming book about police violence against people of color is already generating conversations. Lawrence Ralph is an anthropology professor at Princeton University. His book, called The Torture Letters, is a series of open letters to police, victims, community leaders, and others about the impact of police violence. In the first chapter, Ralph writes about how when he first arrived in Chicago for graduate school, he saw Chicago police frisk two young people. He says that experience reminded him of a similar situation from his own youth and how it impacted him. Here's Professor Ralph.
This is when I was a grad student at the University of Chicago, and I'm walking down a street in an African-American neighborhood, and I see two very young kids getting basically frisked on their way to school, right? And so in that moment, something just compelled me to stop and watch and to see what's going on and see what's happening. And part of me knew that I was watching because I knew it could escalate to violence. And this is a moment, I think, you know, where people have begun, you know, recording the police and in case something happens, right? And so I'm just watching. And later when I'm reflecting on this moment, I realize that part of the reason why I'm watching is because something similar happened to me when I was around that age, you know? And I think that when I was around that age, I had all these questions about, you know, did I do something wrong? Did the people who I were my two older brothers, did we do something wrong? What were we wearing? Did we put our hands in our pocket? Did we walk too fast through the mall? And then, you know, for so many years, I kind of, you know, suppressed that, you know, and had feelings of guilt around that before realizing that this happens every day, all the time, to people of color all throughout the country. And if we never talk about the way it happens and the extent to which it happens, we can't, you know, develop a way to hold police accountable, but also to have police not look at us as threats and say that it's okay to wear what we're wearing. It's okay to be who we are. And that doesn't mean that we deserve to be harassed.
Do you think today, if you noticed a similar situation where officers were arresting or interviewing young African Americans on the street, would you find yourself nervous about what the outcome was likely to be? Would you stop and watch it?
Yeah, I definitely would. I think that's something that hasn't left. I mean, I think what I'm writing about and thinking through now is exactly when and where those kind of feelings of solidarity develop for people who've been victimized by police violence, but also for Black people in general. Like these names, Altrin Sterling, Michael Brown, Botham Jean, Sandra Bland.
Walter Scott.
I mean, these aren't just names. They orient us and make us think about what could potentially happen to us and our loved ones. And so one knows at any given moment, either your name or someone's the name of someone you love can be added to that list. So I think that there is a concern there, and that and there's a need to kind of think about that, you know, every day, you know.
I close with a question that always has a danger of being trite. But I ask it for a reason, and I want to be clear. I'm not asking it in the hopes that you will say yes, or in the hopes that you will sort of assuage any sort of white anxiety. I just want to ask directly, do you feel hopeful that this country will have the kind of policing that you'd like to see within your lifetime?
Wow, that's a good question. I feel hopeful. I have to feel hopeful. You know, I mean, I think that it's easy to say that one doesn't feel hopeful when we look at just the reality of the situation and the momentous challenge before us. But I wouldn't be a professor if I didn't have hope, and I wouldn't write, you know, these books if I didn't have hope, and I wouldn't talk to, you know, police departments across the country and people who have been victimized by the police if I didn't have hope. So I think I have to have hope, and you know, that's what propels me forward.
Next, the Willow Domestic Violence Center is marking 40 years of serving the community. That organization was formally launched in 1979 as Alternatives for Battered Women. Each year, it supports more than 7,000 people in Monroe County. While 90% of those people are women and children, Willow also provides services to men and to the LGBTQ community. In this clip, you'll hear Phyllis Korn, one of the founders of Alternatives for Battered Women, now called Willow. She's discussing what the landscape of domestic violence looked like back in 1979 and why and how she helped found the nonprofit.
There is a quote that I love. Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. Margaret Mead said that and applies to the very courageous people who came before me, who laid the groundwork for the day that we opened the door of our first shelter.
And so at the time, when we talked about domestic violence, was it often referred to as just a private family matter, something to, you know, a private issue between couples, things like that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. Other people weren't supposed to butt in. No one was.
None of our business.
No, nobody is supposed to know about this. We keep it under this, you know, we just don't talk about it. But that was the norm, and also the attitudes. In those days, the man's home was his castle. Boys will be boys. Everyone colluded with the abuser, and it was an enormously difficult pattern to change.
Yeah, a pattern of change behavior, but also the cultural idea that we can talk about this, that victims can mm-hmm. come forward. What do you recall being the biggest mountain to move in that? What was the hardest part about making this change?
I think it was how very many people had to be impacted before there could be real social change. I think we set about making a difference because we wanted to talk to law enforcement. We wanted to talk to teachers, to ministers, to doctors and nurses, to everyone. Our goal was get the word out there. And I think we did it from the minute we opened our eyes in the morning till we went to bed at night.
What did law enforcement say at the time, late 1970s, and you said, we've got to start investigating this more. We have to pursue this.
We met some pretty cold shoulders. We talked to a lot of police chiefs and, you know, their officers, and there were a lot of silent laughs in the background, but they were by and large not terribly supportive.
Were there any single incidents, cases, or moments that you felt like this is a change moment in this community? Now things are turning, or was it sort of a slow build?
I think it was a build. Mm-hmm. I really think it was a slow build. We had so many places, and what I'm saying is not absolute. It certainly was not all of law enforcement. There were some very sympathetic officers, as well as those who snickered behind our backs.
I think for someone maybe of, not to date ourselves, my generation, because I was born in 1979. so was Willow. See, look, we share a birthday. But, you know, for me in my adulthood, the notion that usually men, but not always, but a man could beat his wife, that a man could attack his wife, and that there would not be consequences. It's hard for me to get my head around that. Mm-hmm. But in the late 1970s, if we would have asked the direct question, can a man lay hands on his wife? And the answer, I guess, was
he could. Was under yes. The right circumstances, he absolutely could. And frequently, nobody else would ever know. And when the officers were called, the response usually was to tell the guy to take a walk around the house mm-hmm. Around the block so she could leave quietly.
I imagine now it's a very different landscape, and we're going to talk about that this hour, for victims to come forward, and still very difficult, and probably always will be. I mean, nobody gets into a relationship because they expect or want to be abused. But I cannot imagine what it was like in those early days, trying to convince people, yes, you can come talk about this. Yes, there are services. Yes, we can seek an investigation and pressing charges. I mean, what was that like?
Almost unheard of. Yeah. The laws had to change, and they did. They began changing. But there are so many forms of abuse. It is so insidious. It is so multifaceted. Everything from the financial and emotional and the things that nobody else sees to the woman who comes to work or goes to the doctor's office and has a big bruise under her eye and nobody asks how she got it.
Yeah, that's another thing. I mean, the physical signs of abuse was the sort of the cultural reaction, was it to ignore it if usually a woman shows up at work or in a social situation with a black eye, bruises, etc., and did she often feel compelled to try to kind of cover up or deflect on that?
Yeah. Oh, she would cover it up with makeup, or she simply wouldn't show. She simply wouldn't be where people expected her to be, where she was in the public eye at all. She'd stay home.
We'll end the week with a powerful conversation about disability pride. Stephanie Woodward is a victims of crime attorney at the Empire Justice Center, and she's a disability rights activist. She was born with spina bifida and uses a power wheelchair. The Spina Bifida Association recently asked her to write an op-ed about her thoughts on her disability. She says they asked her to write the piece because her opinion is different from those of many people who have disabilities. You can read the entire piece on the Spina Bifida Association's Facebook page, but here's an excerpt. Woodward writes, quote, "Because I love my disability identity, I have never seen my disability as a problem. And because I have never seen my disability as a problem, I have never supported curing spina bifida or even preventing it. In fact, when I hear someone say, 'I think the world would be a better place if we could prevent babies from having your disability in the future,' what I hear is, 'I think the world would be a better place without people like you,'" end quote. We talked about that and about the praise and pushback Woodward has received on that piece, and also the discrimination she has faced throughout her life. In this clip, she talks about what some adults used to say to her parents when she was a child.
"I can remember being little and wondering if anybody would ever love me when I'm grown up, because I overheard adult conversations, right? And adults are much crueler than children ever were. So overhearing adults talk to my parents and say, 'Well, she'll never get married. Because, I mean, look at her.' These were the things that I overheard, or I specifically remember a case in Canada where a man killed his daughter who had a disability, and his daughter had CP, but when the news broadcaster described her, she sounded very much like me. She had limited mobility. Bladder and bowel sounded similar to when I was around 7 or 8. Everything sounded similar, and I remember overhearing some women talking to my mom saying, 'Well, I could understand why the father killed her. It must have been such a burden to have a disabled child.' And I remember wondering, like, will my mom kill me? And they said, 'Well, like, obviously he loved her. He killed her out of love.' And I'm like, oh gosh, my mom loves me. What if my parents kill me out of love? Like, that's a really scary thing to grow up and have to wonder and I wondered for a long time.
What do you think now of this idea that a parent could murder a child out of love?
I mean, I've obviously learned since then. The reason I remember learning is this is going to sound very silly. After that, I threw funerals for myself in my room for a while because I was convinced that if I was going to die, I had to like really be prepared for it.
Wow. How old were you?
I was about 7 or 8. I had my stuffed animals that would all like have eulogies for me. I had a very active imagination. And I remember that it was my mom who had like walked in and was like, "What are you doing?" And I was like, I'm having a funeral in case you ever kill me. And she like was like, "What are you talking about?" And so I had explained like the girl on TV, and she's like, I was like, "The dad, he killed her because he loved her." And she's like, "Oh, no, no, honey, no. He did not kill her because he, like, that's not love." And she had to like explain to me like that's not what parents do when they love their kids, and that's not like the news shouldn't have said that, like her friends shouldn't have said that. But for me, like that's still a memory that is very vivid in my head, and it's still something I see on the news to this day.
Yeah, and we've talked about it on this program with local stories in which, a parent has killed a child. Is that issue entirely over for you? I mean, do you think now there's obviously no justification for killing a child? Can you empathize at all with that mindset?
No, I could never, ever justify or empathize with the idea that it would be okay to kill anyone, and period, but certainly not say, well, it's okay because they're disabled.
Take away the physical violence, the frustration or the burnout that parents claim to feel at times. I say claim to feel. I want to honor what people say they are feeling when parents say they sometimes can feel that.
I think all parents feel burnout. Absolutely. And I am sure that parents with the children of disabilities feel burnout. And I think that there are certainly ways that you can address that without murdering people.
Now, when we talk about your feelings on disability, I said at the outset, you might have been surprised that the Spina Bifida Association asked you to contribute a little piece on it, just because it is different than some advocate or express. Were you surprised that they said, sure, let's do this?
I was really surprised because I know that my position is different than theirs and from most people. Many people, I wouldn't say most people, because a lot of younger people with spina bifida are changing perceptions and do share my views. So, but there are a lot of people who are not young millennials that have disability pride identities. So when they reached out to me after I've been pretty vocal about my opinion, and they said, hey, you have a different opinion.
You've been critical.
Oh, very openly.
Mostly stemming from what? Language about a cure?
Cure language specifically, and a lot of I'm opposed to money going towards prevention efforts rather than going towards quality of life efforts, because I think it's very important to look at research to improve the quality of life of people with disabilities rather than prevent disabilities from occurring.
So first of all, credit to them for saying, we may disagree with you, but we want to hear your views and we want to air them.
Absolutely.
Know. Yeah, good for them. Now, did you know that expressing it the way you feel on this kind of a venue could lead to some criticism?
Absolutely. I mean, my opinion is different than the majority of what parents feel all of the time. Most parents want a cure or prevention for their child. So I had no doubt that parents would feel different. And I know that there are plenty of people with spina bifida that would feel different than me, and that's okay. I mean, I'm not here to change your mind about how you feel about yourself, but I do hope that future generations will embrace their identity and feel some sort of pride rather than feel like they're a burden.
Can I read a little bit more from your piece?
Sure.
So here's some more of what Stephanie Woodward wrote for the Spina Bifida Association earlier this month. Quote, I regularly hear people with spina bifida talk about how their spina bifida didn't stop them, and that phrase always confuses me. Of course spina bifida doesn't stop us. Our disability isn't a conniving monster dead set on bringing us down. At least, that's never how I viewed spina bifida, end quote. So let's talk a little bit about that. When people say, spina bifida didn't stop me, if they were to say to you, look, you know what I mean. I mean, there are certain limitations I may have, and why is it a problem to say that? Be specific. What bothers you about spina bifida didn't stop me?
What bothers me is we're focusing on the wrong thing. what you mean to say is the discrimination I experienced in society didn't stop me. I don't think that anyone thinks that their disability is really what is stopping them, because I don't believe there's anything about the diagnosis of spina bifida or any other disability that is actually stopping people. I think it is the discrimination and the inaccessibility in society that is stopping people. So people are like, my spina bifida didn't stop me from getting a job. Why would spina bifida stop you from getting a job? Like, you're still completely capable of getting a job. What in the world would make you think that you're not, except for the world telling you? Maybe it's teachers that told you you weren't capable. Maybe it's employers that told you that they don't take people like you. But that's not your disability. That is the world that is at fault. That is not on you.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can find Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 at WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM. We are also on the WXXI mobile app. I'm Megan Mack. Thanks for joining me, as always. Have a great weekend, everyone, and we'll talk to you Monday.